This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. As any good Trekkie will tell you, this year marks the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, the science fiction TV show that became a cultural phenomenon many years after its initial three-season run in the 1960s. Space, as Trek reminds us, is the final frontier. And humans are still trying to make sense of that mostly unexplored terrain with every new technological advancement and ambitious foray into the unknown expanses of the universe. Right now seems an especially intriguing time to be looking beyond our own third planet from the sun. There are a number of exciting missions taking place, including a launch later tonight to reach an asteroid and retrieve some of it to bring back to Earth for study. And while Matt Damon as an astronaut stranded on Mars was a work of Hollywood fiction, on the real island of Hawaii, a group of six people recently completed a year simulating what life on Mars would be like, only being allowed to emerge from their closed-in pod wearing the kind of protective space gear they'd have on if, in fact, they were living on the red planet. We're going to delve into these and other compelling space developments with our guests today, one of whom has been where most of us have and never will boldly go. Colonel Gerald Carr is a retired NASA astronaut, now living in Manchester, Vermont, and he joins us on the line. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And here with me in our VPR studios in Colchester is John O'Meara, Associate Professor of Physics at St. Michael's College. Welcome, John.
Thanks, Mitch. Happy to be here.
And if you're as curious and fascinated by the mysteries of space as we are, we welcome you to join the conversation. You can write to us on our VPR Facebook page or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.net or just give us a call at 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. And Colonel Carr, I'd like to start with you. You were commander of Skylab 4, and that was the third and final manned visit to the Skylab Orbital Workshop. What was the mission of that workshop?
Well, the mission, there were three actual goals to be accomplished. Number one is determine what it takes to have humans be weightless for an extended period of time. The second main task was to study the Earth and to study the sun. And so we spent all of our time doing mostly those three plus 53 other smaller experiments, some of which were high school kids experiments.
Really? High school kid experiments? What were they doing?
NASA in those days treated the high school kids just exactly the way they did a principal investigator for NASA. The youngster would propose an experiment to be done on Skylab, and NASA looked at all of these proposals and selected several. There were 25 of them, actually, for the Skylab program, and those experiments were assembled under the supervision of the student and packed away on the spacecraft. And on orbit, we performed their experiments for them and recorded all the data and voice data as well as digital data. And we sent them, brought them back down with us. And the student at that time had to be, again, treated just like a principal investigator. He or she had to write a full technical report about their experiment and submit it to NASA, according to regular adult, so to speak, experiments.
Wow, that is not your usual typical sort of dry science experiment in the classroom there. How long were you up in space with Skylab?
I was up for 84 days.
84 days?
Yes.
Wow. Now, you were immersed in the work, I'm sure, but there must have been moments when you took stock of the view from where you were and just marveled. I mean, how does it feel to see the Earth from so far above it?
Oh, it's an incredible experience. From the window of our spacecraft, we could see I guess you would call it a circle or a view of 1,200 miles in diameter below us.
Wow. Were you always, from an early age, interested in being an astronaut? You know, were you one of those typical kids who said, when I grow up, I'm going to be an astronaut, or did you come to this later in life?
No, because when I was a kid, there was no such thing as an astronaut. The only ones that we knew of were Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers in the comic strips.
Still, that must have been a little compelling to a kid looking at those adventures back in the day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. John O'Meara, you and I spoke just a couple of weeks ago when you were in Hawaii and had access to the Keck Observatory and a very powerful telescope. What were you looking for?
We were spending our time mostly looking for the fuel that helps galaxies form and process stars. So, you know, when we look inside the Milky Way, we see a couple hundred billion stars, and those stars are made out of hydrogen and helium and a few other elements. And it's an interesting question to ask, where do galaxies get the fuel to form those stars? If you think of the galaxy like a gas tank in your car, our galaxy has only about a billion years worth of fuel to make stars, but our galaxy has been making stars for well over 10 billion years. And so it's an interesting question of how do you keep filling the gas tank? And so using the Keck telescopes out in Hawaii, we were looking sort of 10 to 11 billion years in the past, watching galaxies form and try to understand how they get the fuel to form their stars.
And are there any theories as to where this fuel is coming from and what the source is?
Oh, sure. We have a large-scale overarching theory for how structure forms in the universe, and it's basically gravity at work and a couple of other atomic processes. But what we don't have is the details, and the details are really how certain types of galaxies get their fuel and what they do with it. And so we're really starting to get down in the weeds and try to understand the details of how these galaxies do these things.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro, there is a space launch that's happening tonight. It's called OSIRIS-REx, and it's heading for an asteroid. And what's it going to do?
Well, asteroids are really interesting for a variety of reasons. The main scientific reason is that most of the asteroids in the solar system have been around since the formation of the solar system, so well over 4.5 billion years. And if you want to understand what the solar system was like when it was forming, it would be great if you could get a chunk of material that has been left alone basically since the formation of the solar system. And that's why we want to study asteroids and comets, because in many respects, they're left over from that early time. And you know, when a chunk comes into the atmosphere and hits the ground here on Earth, it's in some sense polluted. OSIRIS-REx, on the other hand, is going to go out there, actually go around an asteroid, pick a good spot, scoop some up, bring it back, and bring it back to Earth in 2023.
That's pretty cool. So it's an unadulterated sample you're getting.
You know,
it hasn't been polluted by anything here in our Earth's atmosphere. That is amazing. Closer to home, I mentioned that in Hawaii, where you were, six people spent a year pretending, in effect, that they were living on Mars. And Colonel Carr, I want to ask you about that because, you know, you've been up in space, and I just wonder how much value do you think there is in a simulated Mars experiment that's grounded here on Earth? I mean, these folks, they can tell themselves they're ready for a year in space after trying to recreate that experience, but can it really prepare anyone for what life would be like on a planet with such a harsh environment like Mars?
Well, I think those kinds of experiments are very valuable. Before our Skylab flight, we had three astronauts spent 90 days in a can, so to speak, at the NASA Space Flight Center at Johnson. And it was called SMEAT, S-M-E-A-T, and I don't remember now what the acronym means, but Simulated Man something or other. And they worked out a lot of kinks and how to get along on a day-to-day basis and what kinds of things had to be done to keep your environment clean and what kinds of stresses might develop as a result of pretty much isolated for 3 months. So it was a very valuable experiment, and I think it will be very valuable to continue doing that from now on.
We are boldly exploring the exciting developments in space exploration today with our guests, John O'Meara, Associate Professor of Physics at St. Michael's College, and Colonel Gerald Carr, a retired NASA astronaut now living in Manchester, Vermont. You can join the conversation, 800-639-2211. What fascinates you about space exploration? Do you think first contact with an alien civilization is possible within our lifetime? These and other questions will be explored today. Let's go to the phones right now. Bob is on the line from Rutland. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to ask your guest. I was going to say, I know recently an older gentleman was trying to follow it, that NASA's looking at a manned launch to Mars. I was just curious what they'd be using for a double capsule like they used to go to the moon, or what they would use. And also, what about all those near-Earth objects? And I know they track some of the larger ones, but those smaller ones, there must be a lot of them. So thank you.
Colonel Carr, you want to tackle the first part of that question about what kind of capsules might be used?
I think going to Mars, we've already developed a human module to go there. It's called the Advanced Launch System, and Boeing is building it for NASA. It's been tested out to 1,400 miles, and it seems to be working out okay. It looks like an Apollo command module, only on steroids. It's quite a bit larger. It can handle a crew of five. The booster system that they're using, I think they're planning right now on possibly a solid rocket-assisted liquid rocket system to get the first stage up there, and possibly the same kind of a system to boost it on its way to Mars. But during the flight to Mars, they're looking at, for the most part, solar power to man the engines. And, of course, the engines will be tiny little engines with very, very little thrust. But the problem, the thing is, you can get to maintain the same velocity with constantly firing a very low thrust or firing a very high thrust over a short period of time. Hmm. So this concept looks like it's going to work for the what you might call a trans-Mars trip.
And by the way, Colonel Carr, our crack producer team has found out what that acronym SMEET means. It is Skylab Medical Experiment Altitude Test,
yep,
which I'm sure you recall now. John O'Meara, what about the second half of that question from Bob in Rutland? And thanks, Bob, for your call. I think he was talking about near-Earth objects.
Oh, sure. I mean, we have there are a lot of near-Earth objects. Some of them are man-made. In fact, we've got a lot of space junk up there. We have to keep an eye on that, and NORAD does a very good job of trying to track things down to as small as they can, centimeters in size, mostly because for the safety of satellites and for the safety of the astronauts aboard station, and for things like the Hubble Space Telescope. And then there's non-man-made things that are happening all the time. We had a meteor shower fairly recently. That's debris from a comet that went by, and we kind of just went through the tail there. And then there are larger things which we are tracking because we want to make sure we know there's nothing big coming to hit us. And we do a pretty good job of tracking the very largest things. It's the stuff in the intermediate zone. Oftentimes coming from the direction of the sun, that's hard to see because the sun's so bright, you know, pointing a telescope at it is not going to be useful. So the next generation for that is really to put a swarm of satellites up that are designed for this purpose and can look in multiple directions at once and keep track of these things.
We got a question from Rick in Westford for you, John. Puzzled he is by the recent discovery of gravitational waves. He said that he saw on the news that these waves compress space and that scientists use lasers to measure the change. But if space itself is being compressed, shouldn't the laser beam also be compressed, making the detection then impossible?
Actually, it is the compression of the laser beam that makes the detection possible. So it's actually quite a prescient question. The way they do it in very short terms is they make a giant L. And so the L has a laser beam going in one direction along the L and in another direction along the L. And as the gravitational wave comes in, it compresses one direction of the L. And when you recombine the laser light, what you look for is very, very small changes in that recombined laser light. It causes interference. And so if it's being compressed in one direction but not the other because of the incoming wave, you can detect it. The other important thing about LIGO, this is the observatory that did, is that they have two detectors in the United States, one in Washington, one in Louisiana, and they required that both of them detect a signal at the same time because these are extremely sensitive things that can measure when a car drives by. So you want to be able to be sure that you're really actually detecting gravitational waves, and they're building more facilities in Europe and Japan in the coming years.
Didn't this detection of gravitational waves, and correct me if I'm wrong, sort of reaffirm the truth of Einstein's theory of relativity? Was there a connection there?
Oh, absolutely. One of the big predictions out of Einstein's general theory of relativity is the existence of gravitational waves. And so we had inferred its presence from watching very, very close binary stars, neutron stars, but we had never directly detected because it's such a very, very precise, hard measurement to make. And it was only in the recent years through upgrades of this LIGO facility that we were able to do it. And once again, Einstein was vindicated.
Colonel Carr, Rick in Westford also had a question for you, and he asks, when wearing a bulky spacesuit, how do you deal with something as simple as an itchy nose? That's a great question. You can't open the helmet, but an unscratched itch, that must kind of drive you crazy.
Yeah, that is a problem. One of our astronauts, Ken Mattingly, years and years ago, managed to bring his arm out of the arm, out of the hands and the arms of the suit, and bring it up through the neck ring and scratch his nose. But no one else has ever been able to do that.
That's a great trick.
We have inside the helmet, right at the ring, is a little sort of a thing like a couple of fingers, trying, you know, look they're situated such that you could pinch your nose. And that was used for equalizing the pressure in your ears when you were changing altitudes or changing pressures in the suit. And that was a good source of solving the itch problem. But other than that, you just got to tough it out.
That is a tough one. We're about to head for a break, but I want to get this question in first, a little bit more about Mars here. And this is really for both of you. What about getting people to Mars someday? John O'Meara, is there a way to do that makes more sense than just launching a rocket from Earth?
Well, you know, you've got to get people up and you've got to get them there. And then you've got to land them, keep them safe, launch them back and bring them back safe. And each one of those things takes very different types of engineering. You know, launching up to low Earth orbit is very, very different than going the many millions of miles to Mars or you know, for example, landing on Mars and then coming back up. You need all the thrust and you take your fuel with you. So you're adding all your mass with you that you take. And so one way that people have been discussing about staging this out is to go and orbit Mars for a while, to get yourself to Mars, to get accustomed to going to Mars, orbit for a while, and then come back, because then you don't need the fuel for a lander and this, that, and the other thing. And staying on Mars and being healthy there for long periods of time is also an engineering problem, because Mars is not a particularly habitable place. Its atmosphere is so thin that it doesn't do a good job of blocking all the radiation that's coming out from the sun and other parts of the galaxy. And so we need to figure out that engineering problem, but that means we're carrying more stuff there, which means we've got to be having more powerful rockets or multiple launches. And so it's a very difficult problem that's going to take decades to stage out and solve.
Colonel Carr, do you think it'll happen? Do you think it should happen? Should we get men to Mars or women to Mars?
Yes, I think it should happen. I think it will happen, but not as soon as everybody would like it to. I think, in my view, I think we need to have a rehearsal mission, and that rehearsal mission would be to fly to the moon with all of the equipment that we plan to use on Mars, and land on the moon and spend some time there using that equipment, making sure that it works, and getting used to the fact that you're not going to be anywhere where you can do anything, but if you can't fix it, it's done for. I'm all in favor of a rehearsal mission to Mars by going to the moon and testing out all of our systems.
Yeah, you just got a big thumbs up from John O'Meara here, too, who likes that idea. Of course, it's a much shorter trip from the moon to Mars than it would be from Earth to Mars, so that's one possibility, I suppose. We're going to talk much more about space and all the fascinating things going on right now in space exploration right after this break. You're listening to Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm, and we're talking about all the incredible developments in space that have occurred lately and will be occurring in the future. Listeners, would you volunteer, for example, for going to and landing on Mars, even if you knew the ticket was one way and you'd never get back to Earth? Maybe you're that fascinated with being up there and getting to a new planet. Call us at 1-800-639-2211, post on the Vermont Edition Facebook page, or email us, vermontedition@vpr.net. And we're going to talk a little bit more about space exploration, everything that goes with it right now. You know, there was another news story recently that got people who believe that the truth is out there, to borrow from another science fiction TV related show. You know, they got very excited about this. And the initial report said that a signal had been picked up from a sun-like star some 94 million light years from Earth. The signal has supposedly been picked up via a Russian telescope. But John O'Meara, was this really a signal from space that could potentially be aliens trying to make a shout out to Earth?
In great likelihood, no. As much as we would like the answer to be yes,
I agree.
In all likelihood, it was not, for a number of reasons. The first reason is the type of telescope was used looks at a very large part of the sky. You can have telescopes look at a very, very small patch in great detail, or a wider patch of sky in lower detail, kind of like binoculars versus a telescope when you're looking at the moon or something like that. And this particular telescope was looking at such a wide patch of the sky that not only would it be receiving information from that star, but anything in the surrounding around it. The other problem was the frequency of radiation that it was looking for. The radio spectrum, part of the radio spectrum it was looking at, is oftentimes used by terrestrial sources. In part, military sources oftentimes use that specific frequency. So we did detect a signal. It was just human-made in all likelihood. And we have had other telescopes designed for the purposes of looking for signals look at this exact same source, and they've seen nothing.
What about, though, you know, SETI has been putting out the, you know, call outs, let's say, to the universe, trying to detect possible alien life. I mean, do you think this is possible in our lifetime, that we could make some kind of first contact?
Well, I mean, I tend to phrase it in the following way. I think it is entirely possible, if not probable, that within my lifetime we will definitively prove whether or not there's life elsewhere out there in the universe, specifically either in our solar system in very simple life forms on either Mars or Europa, but more importantly, in our local stellar neighborhood. You know, in the coming decades, if we decide to do these things, we have the technological ability and the engineering ability and the scientific ability to build the next great space telescopes, which could look at the atmospheres of these planets going around other stars and detect biosignatures, detect things like methane and water vapor and ozone, things which don't normally occur without having a biosignature to them. That would be detection of life, and there it's a probability argument. We just keep upping the odds, and whether or not we detect a radio signal from something, I can't guess on that. I think it is a noble and worthy project to do. It's relatively inexpensive compared to all the other things, and if it's right, if you get one and you verify it, it is probably the most important discovery ever made. So. Hey, that's not a bad thing to look.
Yeah, most important discovery made. Sure, that's not too bad. We've got a question here from Dave in Albany who says, it should be noted that not everyone agrees that NASA is an appropriate use of taxpayer money at this stage of history. The incredible engineering and technical talents of the people involved in the space industry would be more logically spent in other areas. I realize he says there are many people who find the idea of a colony surviving on another planet exciting. Yes, there have been tech innovations that have come from NASA that have helped here on Earth, but it would seem a much wiser use of resources to focus directly on what will help us solve the serious environmental challenges facing us on our own amazing paradise planet. Colonel Carr, I'd like you to address that question. What do you think about what Dave in Albany thinks about that?
Well, it's a tough argument to refute. There's lots of logic to it, but there's a little bit of dreamer in all of us, and I think we all feel that, I feel anyway, that a certain percentage of NASA's budget ought to be used to be looking out and learning. I agree that this Earth of ours is a beautiful place, and it's got a very, very fragile atmosphere right now, and we are in a situation where there's a probability or a possibility that we can destroy our own atmosphere if we're not careful. So, you know, it goes both ways. I think that the money ought to be spent both ways, and it's just a matter of whatever the priority is at the time. If we end up moving into a situation where the Earth is in precarious position, of course, we'll have to stop spending money going out, looking outside. But on the other hand, if we could keep our own atmosphere under control and keep it valid, you know, then there's no reason in the world why we shouldn't look outside.
Yeah, and I completely agree with that and want to extend it in one other important two ways. The first is that we don't actually spend that much on NASA. We have a $4 trillion plus annual budget, and of that we spend about 0.5% of that on NASA. And the more important point, for money aside, is the inspirational factor that comes along with all of this. I can certainly speak for myself that as a kid watching people like Colonel Carr do what they did, and the people in the early days of the shuttle program are directly linked to me being an astronomer today, me being a professor today, me teaching the next generation of engineers to solve exactly the problems that the listener was identifying. So in many ways, what we do with NASA and what we do with the National Science Foundation is not just look at far-reaching questions like life out there in the universe, but we are inspiring the next generation and training the next generation of people who will solve those big problems. So there's a short game and there's a long game, and NASA is oftentimes very much in both of them, but it's the long game that we should focus on, and it has such great benefits for all of humankind.
Yeah, I think that harkens back to what Colonel Carr was saying, too, about the experiments he did with Skylab and involving those high school students, which I have got to imagine inspired at least a few of them to go on to careers.
Oh, I'm sure it did. In fact, I am told, I haven't verified it yet, but I'm told that they are still doing high school experiments on the International Space Station.
They are.
Wow. We got this email from Andy who asks, is there a particularly good time orbit-wise to go to Mars? In other words, will our orbit align in such a way as to make it advantageous for a launch? And John O'Meara, you're nodding your head, so let me give that one to you.
Yeah, both the Earth and Mars orbit the sun, and so you want to be able to launch at the time when you can use the least amount of fuel to make the shortest trip there. There's some in nomenclature, the Hohmann transfer orbit is this specific orbit that you want to do so that you have one burn at the Earth and one burn at your destination. And this alignment happens roughly every 2 years for the Earth and Mars. And so we just had a lander actually have a malfunction before it was launched, the Mars InSight probe, I believe. And that was supposed to launch this year. And now it's not going to be able to launch till 2018. Because it's about every 2 years that you hit that sweet spot to be able to go to Mars.
Hmm. Colonel Carr, we've got a book recommendation for you. I wonder if you've heard of this book. It's called Packing for Mars by Mary Roach. This was an email we got from Dick. He says it's informative, pragmatic, and funny. I'm not sure if you're aware of this book, but might be one that's up your alley. Have you heard of that one at all?
No, I haven't heard of it, but it sounds pretty interesting.
Okay, so we'll put that on your reading list there.
Okay.
You know, I want to ask about this astronaut named Jeff Williams, who recently got back to Earth. He was with some Russian astronauts, and I understand that Williams may have set a record for the longest time an American has ever been in space. Does either of you know what that record is? Colonel Carr, any idea what the record is for American in space?
It's well over a year, but I know Mark Kelly and his Russian colleague each finished very close to 1 year on orbit on the International Space Station. I'm not sure what it is. Do you know, John?
I think cumulative. I think there's the single trip long duration, and that's about a year. And I think cumulative, for an American, it's a little over 500 days. I believe it was around 520 days for this particular astronaut. And I think the Lifetime Achievement Award goes to somebody for over 1,000 days on.
That's amazing. Is that something that's improved over time, Colonel Carr? In other words, could you have spent that much time out in space back in the 70s when you were with Skylab?
I think so. But what we had to do, we had to learn something from Skylab before we could do what we're doing today. And that is that in order to stay in a weightless environment for a long period of time, the people must exercise, participate in very heavy exercise for long periods of time.
Hmm.
And in our case, we proved that with an hour and a half of today, hour and a half each day of very heavy exercise, we came back in just about the same or better shape than when we launched. The International Space Station astronauts and cosmonauts are exercising from anywhere from 2.5 to 3 hours every day. And it's imperative that you keep your muscles in good shape and your cardiovascular system in good shape, or you'd be a wreck when you return back to 1G again.
What did you notice about returning from your own time in space, Colonel Carr, that really affected you physically? What was the most noticeable thing?
Oh, gosh. I guess the most noticeable thing was vestibular. We had a few days, a little trouble keeping our balance because the otoliths in your ears are little tubes with hairs in them that sense the gravity vector. And when you don't have a gravity vector, you lose that, and you depend on your muscles and your nervous system and your eyes to compensate for it. But then when you suddenly put that vestibular factor back into living back down here on the Earth, it takes about 2 or 3 days to get over that problem.
Got to get your sea legs back, except it's your space legs, I guess you'd call it in this case.
Yeah.
Our VPR producer, Sam Gail Rosen, has this question for John O'Meara. He keeps seeing news stories about something called an EM drive, which theoretically could propel a rocket without the need for any propellant. This sounds totally nuts, Sam says, but it does seem like there are real scientists, including at NASA, who are working on it. Is this real or is it pseudoscience?
Well, the proof is in the pudding. The EM drive was developed in part, the current version, by a team called the Eagle Works team at NASA. They have apparently submitted a paper for publication that has been accepted and come out, but the results in that are embargoed until the paper comes out, and I believe the paper comes out in something like December. I will cast a very, very skeptical eye on any claims of that sort until – you know, A, I see something like the paper, and B, I see it be reproduced by somebody else. The laws of physics are pretty specific when it comes to what you can do and what you can't do. And
I think they're unbreakable too, aren't they?
By and large, yes. So I count myself as a skeptic on this one.
Not everything goes smoothly, of course. In space exploration recently, there was an explosion at the Cape Canaveral Air Force Station. It occurred while the Falcon 9 was being filled with liquid oxygen. Luckily, no fatalities involved in this, but that was a pretty expensive explosion. How much of a setback do you think that was for NASA, Colonel Carr?
Well, the last I heard was that it's going to set SpaceX back to the point where they can't possibly be man-rated. Their vehicle cannot be man-rated until about 2018.
And when you say man-rated, I'm sorry, what do you mean exactly?
That means reliable enough to place a human being in it and launch it.
Okay.
And it requires numbers like 0.997% possible probability of success. And Boeing, at the same time, is competing with SpaceX with another kind of a spacecraft. And they have recently announced, that, as I understand, that they won't be ready either till about 2018. So that means we get to continue forking over around $81 million per person to put our astronauts into our orbit.
Still, this is kind of the cost of exploring space, John, as you were talking about before. You still think, you know, it's worth the cost?
Absolutely. I mean, I tend to be one of the people who think that that NASA should go back to doing what they do, which is doing the impossible or the near impossible. I harken back to the Apollo days back then, you know, doing it in a decade and the idea of going to establish an outpost on the moon and someday on Mars. And getting into low Earth orbit is something that it's I'm comfortable with passing on to industry once they can prove they can do it routinely and safely. But space is hard. And one need only look back at the early films of the 50s and early 60s to see how hard it was. Mm-hmm. And a number of astronauts have lost their lives doing this. But it is something worth doing and something I hope we can continue to do.
Gentlemen, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I can't let the segment end without asking about Star Trek. And I don't mean to trivialize real scientific work with science fiction, but there are people working on space-related projects today who say they were inspired to explore or study the mysteries of the universe because of that TV show, groundbreaking show. Do you think Gene Roddenberry's vision of a future in which humans will explore space much the same way that captains and sailors once explored oceans on the Earth, you know, do you think that will be realized someday?
Well, personally, I think so. As long as we don't continue to mess up our home base as much as we have, as fast as we have, give ourselves enough time, and we will go out. We are explorers. We've been doing it for thousands of years. We will continue to do it for thousands of years if given the opportunity. And the only way we can continue to explore is deep in the oceans and well out beyond.
Colonel Carr, last word to you. Do you think that we'll be exploring space this the same way that Magellan and all the great explorers went to sea?
I think so. I think there must be some sort of an element in our DNA called exploration. And I think everybody has it, and it's just whether or not you develop it very well, or whether you decide it doesn't get developed and you do other things with your life.
And Colonel Carr, do you miss it? Would you go back to space if you had the chance?
Well, I'm 84, so I don't think I could do it. But
if you could.
If I could, I certainly would, yes. In fact, I would have liked to have flown on the International Space Station because my colleague Bill Pogue and I worked for Boeing as a subcontractor and helped develop all of the manned systems inside the International Space Station. So I'd like to go up and see our handiwork.
Hmm. Colonel Gerald Carr, retired NASA astronaut, now living in Manchester, Vermont, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure.
And John O'Meara, an associate professor of physics at St. Michael's College, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mitch, and thank you, Colonel Carr. It was great to talk to you.
And coming up, kids are not the only ones heading off to college. Some parents are taking an online course to be better prepared for having their children head to school. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Mitch Wertlieb in for Jane Lindholm. This fall, more than 20 million students are expected to attend college in the United States. For first-year students and their parents, it's an especially exciting and bittersweet time. For parents who have not been to college themselves, however, it can be confusing and unclear how best to be supportive. And for parents who may be too involved with their kids, the so-called helicopter parents, it can be hard to let go. That's why for the first time, Green Mountain College in Pulteney has an online course for parents to help them adjust to and better support their child in college. VPR's Nina Keck has more.
As colleges go, Green Mountain is small. It's nestled between the Taconic and Green Mountains, and its stately red brick buildings house slightly more than 400 students. Another 130 commute or are in graduate studies. For those living on campus, this past Friday was move-in day.
Thank you.
Where'd you guys park?
Right out here in front.
Okay. We'll follow you.
All right, great.
Kathy Bradley of Perkinsville, Vermont, helped her son Michael unload boxes, while junior Cody Bradshaw, a student dorm advisor, helped out. Michael Bradley pointed to his new twin bed with a doubtful look toward his mom. At 6'5", it's clear he'll need something longer.
I was going to say, I think you're going to hang off that bed, Mike.
I'll work on it. Yeah, I just have to contact Chris in our office. Does a lot of the extended bed frames, so we'll figure it out.
This is not Kathy Bradley's first time seeing a child off to college. Her oldest son just graduated from Castleton, and she attended Green Mountain College herself. Still, when I mentioned the college has created a new online course specifically designed for parents, she plans to check it out.
Just to more information. It makes you feel more at ease. Anytime, I'm probably an overprotective mother, but anytime I'm entrusting my child to someone else, the more information I can have about where he's at and what he's doing and what they're expecting from him, you can all be on the same page.
The room.
Thank you.
And we'll see you guys 6:30 tonight. Where it's on your schedule. We have a building meeting tonight.
Okay.
So we will see you. And like
upstairs, more first years are welcomed and given the lay of the land. Lucas and Bernadette Foster of Lowell, Massachusetts, are moving in their only daughter, Sarah. Lucas says he's not sure how helpful a parent's course would be to him, but his wife, Bernadette, likes the idea. She completed college a few years ago as an adult and never experienced what it was like to live on campus.
I think it would have been more helpful for us in particular if we had been offered something earlier in the stages of getting to this point, because that's where we've had our most difficulties. Like, where do we do? Where, you know, we commuted 4 hours to get here and we didn't have all the things we needed when we got here, and that was confusing, and I couldn't really provide her with help. Like, oh, this is how you do it. And I'm the parent, I know. I have no idea. I'm looking at her to tell me what we need.
Besides providing information on coursework, faculty, and campus life, the online parents course also provides tips on how best to support a college student without over-parenting. Luke Krieger is in charge of residence life at Green Mountain College. He says uber-involved parents can be frustrating, but he says college administrators are starting to look at the phenomenon differently now.
We look at helicopter parents, and that's an asset. You want parents who are connected and involved. You just have to, you need to utilize that energy somehow.
He says Virginia Commonwealth University gave a workshop on this last year at a conference he attended, and he says they talked about an online course they created for first-year parents, which really impressed him. Heather Keith, a philosophy professor and administrator, liked the concept as well. She led the team that designed the new parents course for Green Mountain College.
not just giving them a web page with information, but really giving them the opportunity to learn something about the college and about the education their students are getting.
Keith says the college wants students to learn to advocate for themselves and be resilient, so the course provides parents with tips on how to encourage that as well. At a parents' orientation meeting, Arena Martin said she drove up from Long Island and was thrilled to hear about the course for parents. She'd grown up in Russia and gone to college there. A very different experience, she points out, from what her daughter will likely get in Vermont.
That's why I'm like blindfolded. I am discovering and developing everything the way she is. And it's unfortunately, I'm not the best person to advise her certain things because I've never done it. So I go ask other people. So this program is for people like me is actually the best.
Martin's eyes tear up as she talks about heading back to Long Island without her daughter. Now, if the college could just design a class to make those goodbyes a bit easier. For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Pulteney.
And by the way, we have a link to Green Mountain College's new parenting course on our website, vpr.net. And now it's time to read some of your emails and comments on past shows, and I'm joined by Vermont Edition producer Sam Gale Rosen. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Mitch. Many of you had feedback on our show last week on the science of kids and added sugar in foods. Nicole posted, "We are very conscious about what our child who is 5 eats because he has type 1 diabetes. The biggest surprise was the amount of added sugar our kid was fed in preschool and school. We would be called in at least once a week because there would be a birthday cupcake or a cake made to enhance teaching, or juice served. Even if my kid didn't have diabetes, I would be outraged about the amount of sugar given to my child without a consent form."
And a listener with the screen name NLPNT commented on the picture we had up on our website of cookies, candy, and cupcakes. "Isn't the stock photo of sweets a bit misleading, since those aren't as worrisome as added sugars in foods that aren't normally sweet? Some mass-market allegedly savory crackers are, if not quite disgustingly sweet, a lot worse tasting than they would be if they weren't loaded with high-fructose corn syrup for whatever food engineering reasons."
We also got a lot of response to our show on how Vermont Republicans are responding to the Trump campaign. One issue that came up on the show was Donald Trump's campaign pledge that veterans will be able to get their care from private facilities. In response, Vincent in Bakersfield posted, "Bernie Sanders and John McCain were instrumental in the creation of the CHOICE program for veterans using the VA healthcare system. The CHOICE program allows veterans to go to the doctor of their choice if they are more than 40 miles away from a VA hospital or clinic. I'm very happy with the program. My doctor is in Johnson, but I went to the UVM Medical Center for heart surgery last October. All was covered by the VA. Mr. Trump will not create this program. Bernie and John McCain already have."
And KT posted this comment, "I find it very disconcerting that some of your listeners equate presidential candidate Donald Trump's shortcomings, whatever those might be, with the Vermont Republican Party's ability to provide a viable alternative to the failed Democratic governance of the state. The vast majority of the constituents in my district, whom I've spoken with, are far more concerned with the poor condition of Vermont's economy than they are with the he said, she said antics of the presidential campaign."
When we re-aired our conversation with Joseph Mazur about his book, Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, we got a whole new crop of coincidence stories from listeners. Jim in South Hero emailed, "In 1970, I lived in Ipswich, Massachusetts, and had an old 1936 Chevy. I was not keeping it up as I should have and sold it. Fast forward 10 years when I had moved to Colorado and eventually Penton, Vermont. I was visiting a friend in Ferrisburg when I noticed an old car under a tarp in his garage. I said it looked like an old Chevy, and upon further investigation, I found that it was the exact car I had sold 10 years earlier. It had been bought and sold several times and ended up in my neighborhood in Vermont."
Wow. And we also got a great email from Sarah, who tells the story of meeting the same man 3 different times, first in Mexico, then 3 years later at a meditation retreat in Thailand, where she couldn't say hi because everyone was in silent meditation. She thanks Zen. Then she got another chance to reconnect, though, 2 years later in Saratoga Springs. Hey, keep us updated on the next time you two run into each other, Sarah.
Finally, Joseph in Greenfield Center, New York, posted on Facebook, "This is a coincidence from many years ago when I was running a college program at Great Meadow Correctional Facility. As part of the interview process, people would sometimes submit samples of their writing. One young man submitted a poem that he said he had written. My response to him was, good poem, but you have one line wrong. Why is that? He asked. Because, I said, it is a poem that I wrote. It had appeared in obscure little magazine 7 years before that.
Well, if you have a coincidence story, a poem you'd like to pass off as your own, or any other comments on anything else that's been on the show, you can always email us at vermontedition@vpr.net.
You can also always comment on our website or Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
And about a year ago, Vermont's mental health community and gun owners began work on a project to prevent the use of guns in suicide. It's one of the ways that Vermont is trying to lower its suicide rate, which is above the national average. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we'll look at suicide prevention strategies. So join us live at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Rick Sangari, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Liam Connors directed the program, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. Our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Mitch Wertlieb, in for Jane Lindholm, and thank you so much for listening to Vermont Edition.